You are listening to Emerging Communities Ancient Roots, Episode 14, Debbie Gish of the Church of the Sojourners. Debbie Gish is a founding member of Church of the Sojourners in San Francisco's Mission District, a community of the Shalom Mission Communities Network. She works as an adoption social worker and, with her husband Dale, is parent to two daughters, Annalise and Rebecca. In our conversation, Debbie and I discuss the emergence of Sojourners as both church and community from a small collective of five young women and three older couples with children engaged in urban ministry in the mid-1980s. Debbie speaks of the community's search for healthy balance and boundaries in their life and ministry together, which led to the development of a particular self-understanding as church that emphasizes loving one another well as the body of Christ. This understanding manifests in a form of ministry and hospitality that Debbie describes as functioning primarily as the inn to which people are brought to heal, rather than the Good Samaritan who first encounters those in need. Debbie also shares about her own learning process through 25 years of communal living, from an exuberant honeymoon period to a deeper realization of community as her way of living out her discipleship to God, the joys of living through the various stages of her life in close company with others, and a grasp of the necessity of stability and commitment to human flourishing. Finally, since Church of the Sojourners is often identified with the New Monasticism, and Debbie and other members were present when the 12 marks of the New Monasticism were developed, we spend some time talking about the strengths and challenges in this vital emerging community movement. Here's my conversation with Debbie Gish.
So the origins are that we were five single women who had just graduated from college. All of us come from an university Christian fellowship background, was our context, and had explored themes of community, all interested in urban ministry. And I personally wasn't, I was the fifth wheel to the four who came out of UC Irvine, or UC Santa Cruz. I went to UC Irvine. But the four of them had met three couples who were doing urban ministry here in San Francisco, coming out of a conservative Baptist background. And they decided to mentor themselves to them, to find people who were further along in the faith. They were in their 40s, had, you know, school-aged children. They were all early 20s. And wanted to go out in partnership, but also learn from people further along in the journey. So they had come to San Francisco and had decided to, well, they're mostly working with Central American refugees. This was the mid-80s when there was, you know, the wars were raging in Central America. There was a huge influx in this neighborhood of mostly Salvadoran and Guatemalan refugees. One of the couples had a law clinic, an immigration law clinic that they were running out of the back of their garage, and a storefront church in the front of the garage. So they decided to go to Central America for like 3 weeks, bringing money and clothing from family members here to family members there that couldn't visit because they were here as undocumented people or refugees or asylum seekers. So they went with, you know, 100 pounds of stuff each, and loads of money to visit families, specific families of people that they knew in the neighborhood, is a way to kind of contextualize the context of what these people were living here.
For them to get an experience of what's actually happening.
Right. And what's really happening. I mean, the war was going on. This was 85. So they went to Guatemala, they went to El Salvador, they went to Nicaragua. So when they were down there, I show up on the scene just from a reference from someone else. Long story short, I lived in Mexico City for a year, was drawn to urban ministry and community. Mexico City was a little big for my taste. The Mission District of San Francisco was like a very small version of. So I was here just exploring options. I just graduated from college, and I met up with the wives of these three men who were traveling with these four other women in Central America. And they started talking about what they were doing and what these women had done and their background with InterVarsity, their longing for community, their vision for urban ministry. And I was like, I found my soulmates. I wasn't even looking for them, but I found them. So when they came back from their trip, I had like looked for apartments for five. And, you know, they're like, who are you? So we had very long discernment times and discussions where they finally decided I was more a confirmation of the vision of what they were going to do and not someone who was going to mess it up.
Right.
Here I am 25 years later and I'm still here. Only one of them is still here. So that was like the embryo of the community, which started out more like a support group of folks doing urban ministries. But the five of us did rent an apartment together, did pool our money, started having daily prayers, you know, had a guest room open to guests. And the families were kind of intrigued by our vision of community. That wasn't what they were really about. They were more about urban ministry, and we were doing kind of both. We looked for jobs in the neighborhood. I was doing refugee resettlement stuff. Another one was volunteering in the clinic because we were pooling our money and she could volunteer. We put another person through school. And the last two worked in preschools. So, you know, we were able to live on pretty minimally because we were pooling our money. So we started meeting together, and we started looking for neighborhood churches, and the couple said, well, why don't you think of us as your church? And they had never self-identified as a church before that. And kind of when we came and kind of brought some of our passion and newness and still a vision for learning from them, kind of the thought of being a church emerged. It wasn't a plan. It was kind of a emergence. So we started studying things together. What does this mean? The first book we read was by Art Gish, Living in Christian Community, who turned out to be my father-in-law eventually.
Oh, wow.
Another 10 years later or so.
Wow.
So that was kind of intimidating when I met him. And at the end of a year, thought maybe we should move in together. So we started looking for our buildings in the neighborhood, and we found a three flat on Potrero Avenue. This is 1986, I believe, now. And at that point, one of the couples said, you know, this isn't what we signed up for, so we're moving on. And so the two couples with their kids, who were middle school down, and five single women, moved in together. And so that was the beginning of a beautiful relationship. So as we began, like I said, we had a self-understanding of church, but I think in our life together had more of a self-understanding of being a ministry. Of those first years when we bought the building and even before, had a pretty open door policy about who came in, and anyone with any interest could come in. I mean, one thing to say, it was not this era where everyone's looking for community.
Right.
This was the wake of, you know, we were in Jim Jones land here. You know, people were very cautious of community in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
No one, you know, if you're thinking community, you're thinking good friends who support each other.
Mm-hmm.
You're not shacking up, you know.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, a lot of our families were really concerned, friends were concerned. And so we weren't having a lot of door knockers that were interested in community. But we did have a lot of need.
Yeah.
And so several of us volunteered at a local shelter, and, you know, girlfriends of refugee would stay with us, or somebody in crisis. That there was just a ever flow of people. One of our couples did work with student ministry, so we did have student groups that would come through kind of in big groups of 10 or 20 and stay for a weekend and do kind of an urban plunge sort of thing. So there were people that could sustain that for their lives, you know, that could sustain that sort of ever crisis, ever flow of people talking about what you're doing all the time, dealing with a battered person or an addict or whatever. And there was other people who couldn't deal with that level of life intensity, that there's really no boundaries between your home and your church and your ministry and everything else. So there arose many, many discussions. what is the nature of this life together that we're creating? And a couple years into it, we did form a covenant of what are the things we're committed to and what's the vision of who we want to be. In the early 90s, or late, I think it was 89, I don't know if you know who he is, but John Alexander and Judy Alexander, he was, he founded The Other Side magazine with his father. He had lived and been part of many different communities, and they kind of came to us in a time when we were looking for vision development and who are we. And they were also in somewhat a time of need. And so we called on them for guidance, and then they ended up being drawn to who we were and ended up moving here. So as John came on, who had, he didn't have a classic charismatic personality, but he had a very strong sense of vision. And he brought to us kind of a concrete articulation of how to be the church that includes what it means to be the church for the world, but what it means to be the church for each other. And so he brought some forms that included times when it would just be people that were committed, like a retreat or a certain meetings. He also brought things like date night, family night, to help maintain the family units and the vision for marriages to be healthy, that it wasn't always an open door policy. And also brought a really clear articulation of a ecclesiology that helped us see that loving each other well is not just navel gazing. It is not just a mutual affirmation society. That is actually what we're called to be as the body of Christ in a way that ends up being your witness. And so loving each other well, laying down your lives for each other, dealing with your own stuff, being honest about your sin, being honest about the brokenness of the guy at the top and the brokenness of the guy at the bottom matters a ton. Because it isn't how cool your brochures are and how great your website is or what wonderful programs you have. It's how you treat each other and what happens behind closed doors that actually gets seen. And that's the beauty and the tragedy. And in some ways, we shouldn't hide how bad it is, because that's the proof that we need God in the first place. So at that juncture of really developing an ecclesiology that makes church central, there was some parting of ways of folks who really felt like ministry, in the classic sense of the word, should be at the forefront of what we're doing. So some people came and some people left in those juncture years. So for me personally, it became difficult to articulate what is our ministry. And I grew to hate that question, honestly, because the answer to be the church was never enough, especially in the wake of the new monasticism, when a resurgence of interest in ministry, in being in the abandoned places, for the abandoned folk, etc. It needs to be very concrete and obvious what you're doing. And I think in time, I eventually came to a place of realizing, no, this is a great question. What is your ministry? This is the most important question, and it's okay to articulate what I really think. And that to be the church isn't a cop-out answer. And I feel like to be the church for the world means that you keep your door cracked ajar. Keep your door ajar. And you welcome who God brings your way. So if you leave your door ajar, I promise you God will bring people. If you slam it shut, it won't happen. But if it's flung wide open, you're playing God. And that there needs to be discernment. I like to use the language of adoption versus the language of an after-school program. Or an after-school program, you just keep saying yes to the same kid over and over.
Oh, I see.
Versus a child that you say, I'm saying yes to you forever. And so we're going to walk this journey together as family. So they ceased being, so as a family member, and both my, adoption is my language because my children are adopted and I'm an adoption social worker, but that you don't always introduce your child as the adopted child. In fact, you never do.
Right.
And in the same way, when do the poor you're ministering to, or the prostitute, or whoever, when do they cease being that label and become family? And so we try to not say who's being ministered to and who's not, because it can be any of us at any given time. Mm-hmm. And so when people ask, where is your ministry? You know, I'm not going to go around the room and say, okay, that one's my ministry.
Right.
Okay, and you're my ministry, and you're my ministry. Because I think the church does objectify people.
Yeah.
And in some ways, it's right to call attention to things, but in some ways, it perpetuates a certain problem and a certain arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
For the people of
Absolutely.
God. And so, what is our ministry? It's being open.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a woman here who came to us as a battered person. And I remember when she was leaving, she said, you know, I was tired of being the ministry. In many ways, Christians need to justify what they're doing by labeling and naming the people that they're doing it to.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really hit me. You know, it was more complicated than that, why she actually left.
Sure.
But it was true.
Yeah.
You know, that when someone would ask, what are you doing? Oh, well, we took in her. You know, I mean, it wouldn't be that
crass. Right, right, I understand.
But she knew that people, you know.
Yeah.
I think everyone's story is important. But just as my children's adoption story is part of their story, it doesn't define who they are.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't the label of who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't have this line of what is the ministry we do.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a soup kitchen. We don't have a thing that we're doing. But we try to keep our door open and know when we're playing God and when we're being invited by God to do things.
Yeah.
And there's a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And it's subtle. And sometimes it's yes, and sometimes it's no.
One of the things that I find interesting with that perspective is that it's actually a lot closer to the monastic idea of hospitality and ministry than a lot of these new monastic communities. In Benedict's Rule, there's a big emphasis on welcoming the stranger, the poor, welcoming them as Christ. But that simply means that you're there, you're present.
Mm-hmm.
The door is ajar, as you say, but you don't necessarily go into the streets and go looking.
Right.
That's a different charism, so
right.
to speak.
Right.
So I think you're actually more in line with the classic monastic model.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Without planning.
Right, exactly.
One analogy some people use is that we're more the inn of the Good Samaritan story than the Samaritan.
Okay.
And that kind of, when people kind of get the, I think legitimate and genuine, sincere conversion, often the vision is to always be the Samaritan.
Yeah.
But where are people brought? The inn is where the healing is taking place over the long haul,
yep.
God willing.
Yep.
Not to diminish the importance of being the Samaritan.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I actually think Thomas Merton wrote somewhere that the monastic doesn't presume to go out to whom they believe they need to be ministering to. Rather, they trust God to
mm-hmm.
bring to them
mm-hmm.
whom God
right.
chooses.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah.
And at least to date, we've had enough. We haven't felt the lack
right.
of God bringing people.
You've had a full house.
We've had a full house.
Yeah. So how would you describe your own learning process over the years in community?
I mean, I think I came into community so excited. I grew up in a fairly dysfunctional family in the suburbs, upper middle class, where, you know, kind of our public persona was well respected in the community and our family life was a disaster. And so coming to community and finding kind of a new vision for family was very refreshing to me,
mm-hmm.
very exciting
mm-hmm.
to me, and kind of living a very open together faith was just exhilarating to me. So the year together, the five of us, was my honeymoon year
yeah.
of community. You know, other people thought it was crazy. And I was like, oh, you guys just don't know how crazy it can be. So I came with much enthusiasm and joy and feeling like my whole life was being integrated and it didn't have
mm-hmm.
to be this over here and that over there. And so So I think I lived with much excitement and thrill of newness for quite some time. I think I also came to a place where, man, if this thing fell apart, I would fall apart. I particularly remember that there was someone who was going through a crisis and threatening to leave the community and leave their marriage and just like themselves in crisis. And I was kind of undone. It felt like my world was about to fall apart because their world was about to fall apart. And I remember very particularly being in my bed and crying and kind of being in crisis a little bit myself and feeling like God said to me, this is unto me. This is not me. You know, like, you are living this life unto the Lord. And I don't know how well I can describe what that meant to me, but it meant that this life I'm living in faithfulness to the Lord, this isn't my salvation in and of itself. That this is how my commitment to Jesus is made concrete in the world. That you can have a faith that says, I believe in Jesus or I follow Jesus, but it has to have concrete place of submission and giving yourself. And I felt like that was a turning point for me too, that this life I live is just a place to do it, like a place to live out what I say my submission to God is about. So it takes concrete reality in submitting to the voice together that we discern, or in loving someone who's difficult to love, that Jesus is calling us to difficult things at times, and they're kind of mundane most of the time.
Right.
And so that was kind of a turning point for me, that there may have been a little bit of idolatry
right.
of the community
yeah.
to realizing, no, this is the playing field. This is where I'm living out my discipleship, and it's unto the Lord.
And how long had you lived in community by that point, approximately?
I can remember what room I was sleeping in. Probably 5 years
okay.
or more.
Okay.
Yeah. That was a big turning point for me. I mean, I've lived here as a single person. I've lived here as a dating person. I've lived here as a newlywed and someone starting a family. And so I think all of those junctures had, you know, different faces of what this life together means. But for me, I've never really questioned this is what I'm to do or where I live out my discipleship in any of those junctures. And have felt very blessed to live each of those life stages in this context and together with other people. So even though there's growing things about all of those things, I feel like those changes in my particular life have only been better because of living them in the larger communal life with other people. I've been super grateful for the ways it's enriched my marriage, for the ways it's helped me be a better mother, the ways I was single till I was 35, till I was, you know, I wasn't in any rush to get married. I was glad I got to. I didn't need to. So that's been a gift for me, to feel like all of my different life stages have been enriched, and I certainly do hope I get to be old in a context like this, because I feel like I don't want to be old alone.
Yes, yes.
And it's a gift to be able to walk with other people as they're in their aging processes.
Absolutely.
And their dying processes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the thing that that I've come to see as fairly central and not easy to grasp is the concept of commitment. There's just certain things that can't be accomplished in, I think, both ourselves as individuals, as well as a community, as well as a marriage, as well as a parent-child relationship, as well as ministry, whatever, that our culture's infatuation with ever new, ever change is really detrimental to, I think, individual growth as disciples. it's detrimental to the impact we can have on the world. It's kind of a cancer in the church that is causing entertainment to be the highest call. And I think, I don't know how to infuse that vision into the new monasticism.
There's certainly a lot of talk about stability, and so it's definitely in the air.
That's good.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm glad it's becoming more in the air, but it's...
But learning it and doing it is a whole another story.
Right.
Yeah.
And when... You know, and we were as guilty as anybody else in reinventing the wheel. There's something about learning from those who are a few steps ahead and actually being in relationship with them that helps in that. But it's not an easily attained thing. I don't feel like I can say I've been here for 25 years because I understood the nature of commitment and I stuck it out, or something that I feel like it's been more a grace and a gift. But there was a point where I realized I could see the way God works over the long haul in a way that I didn't even know existed, you know. I don't think I could even articulate when you've walked with someone for 20 years what you see versus the miracle of an addict getting clean today. But living with an addict who's clean for 20 years is a different story than one who just got clean. Or I don't even feel like I have analogies to what, because it's so foreign to our culture, what is the depth? You know, I think I always thought of the end result of marriage or commitment was stagnation. And I think that's like prevalent in, you know, if you think ahead of anything like staying in one place or one for, you know, your lifetime, that was like unheard of in my thought process. I had to move away. I had to move on, you know. So there's something that makes it impossible to even talk about the...
Because we don't even have the...
The tool.
We don't have, you said analogy. There's nothing we can point to and say, oh, like that.
Right. And I think we can think of a lot of negative examples.
Yeah,
of,
right.
You know, your parents who stayed together for 50 years and they probably should have divorced at 10. Or, you know, whatever. But also just thinking like in our own history, I can tell the story of how we started so well and articulately. But can I tell you year 10? Can I tell you year 16? We don't, we think in stories that have like big starts and exciting, you know, but how do you tell the story of a growth of a tree? How do you tell that story? You can tell the story of planting it. You can tell the story of chopping it down, but you can't tell the story of the, this week the roots grew this far, this week this, and this snowstorm. And it's very hard, but there's something I think profoundly important and part of God's design of his people in the world that includes that slow, pretty uninteresting story of growth and commitment.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that's an excellent segue.
Into?
Because I wanted to, we've been touching upon this and you've spoken already about it a little bit, but I wanted to get your perspective on the new monasticism movement, which Sojourners is often identified with. What fascinates me is how fast it's developing. And if you look at how soon the literature was coming out, almost right after people were starting communities. It's interesting to look at in light of what you just said, because the initial fervor really carries people along. It it captures people. People are attracted. They participate. But that's just the seed, or the first green shoot. The real life happens in the mundane working out over years. So it's just a curiosity. I think none of us can really say what this tree is going to become because it's still a fresh green shoot. And I think that's one of my concerns, especially looking at it from a monastic point of view, where you enter a lineage of centuries of growth and you insert yourself into that story. It's not as exciting per se. So what's your thoughts? Any reflections?
Yeah, I think when things... I was actually at the gathering when the 12 Marks were born in North Carolina and Raleigh, Durham. And so I can mark it because it was also when I met my daughter's birth mother.
All right.
That weekend I'll never forget.
Yeah.
So one thing that from the get-go I was encouraged about that was different from our beginnings was that there has been a lot of looking to the old monasticism. That people realized we're not starting over. We didn't come up with some incredible biblical insight that nobody else had thought of before, like we had.
Right.
You know, we found Acts 2 and we were the first ones that read it.
Right.
Like, wow, why didn't anybody else know this before? So I felt that there was a humility of kind of the voices that were, you know, I can't say I'm someone who's following all everyone's,
sure.
But my impression from the loudest voices was there was an acknowledgement of this is a stream that's been flowing for a long time and we can participate in something. So that to me was a really important and encouraging and hopeful sign. I think also that one danger, there's lots of dangers, but it's a dangerous thing to do, so that's okay. So the 12 marks, which kind of defines this movement, if you read them, it's 12 chapters written by 12 different people in 12 different contexts. But
and that's the book, 12,
the 12
Schools for Conversion,
yeah.
12 Marks, the New Monasticism.
Right.
Yeah.
So the expectation, if you think of it as kind of a handbook on community, is that, these are 12 marks and I live these 12. We must form our community with these 12 marks. Well, each one is describing the charism of a particular group.
Right.
And that there, I think for me, coming to a place of accepting your charism and not thinking you collectively or you individually need to embody all that is the faithful life.
Yeah.
You know, is it earth care? Is it the abandoned places? Is it, I mean, there are certain ones in there that I think are key to every community. I also don't know what to make of how it, in some ways, in the Protestant world especially, in some ways represents a further exodus from the church, the mainline church. That, you know, I honestly wish that we ourselves had never just broken away. And, you know, I think that the eternal splitting post-Reformation of the body of Christ is just a sadness for God. And that, how do you be and consider yourselves and function as part of the larger body without further splintering it or further disabling the body that as people come out of maybe churches they grew up in or et cetera, to start it all over in this context? I wish there was more of a marriage like the Catholic Church can do with monastic movements into the Mother Church, that the Protestant world, we don't know how to envision that. So the new kid who gets really excited about Jesus and following him radically has to leave versus finds his place within the body or is schooled by those who are wiser than him. You know, that it feels like we've bought the psychology's analysis of you need to break away in order to have your own identity. How can the church be different?
Yeah.
And I don't have an answer for that, but all the breaking of new and starting of new has, it just feels like further splintering of the church while I'm still a part of that. And I was part of that, you know, and we're not part of a denomination. So I speak, you know, with some hopefully humility in saying that's sad, you know, and I don't know what to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want people to not live faithfully, but I don't want it to be a rejection of the church and, you know, the blue-haired ladies who have been faithful for years in showing up.
Yeah.
And you don't know what she's lived through. And so I think there's some quick judgment in those who have remained faithful to the mainline church for lifetimes or generations that may be unfounded and naive or something. But, I mean, I am glad. Time will tell.
Yeah.
What will happen. And I'm grateful for those. There's people who have vision for saying, let's learn from older communities. Let's seek help when we're in crisis.
Right.
And that's new. We didn't have any of that as we started. And that's exciting to me.
Yeah.
And that is further evidence of kind of a corporate humility in the movement that is so necessary. I mean, there's just been junctures, if we didn't have other people outside of ourselves, I don't know what we would have done.
Right.
You know, and just saying we need help is okay and it's good and it's part of the journey.
Speaking about the splintering of the church, there's a mark for that. I believe it's number 5.
Which is?
And,
oh, right.
Humble submission to Christ's body, the church.
That's good.
And interestingly, my first interview for this podcast was with a man who had also attended, and that was one of the questions that I had for him. It's like, well, okay, you've got this very eclectic group, ecumenical group of people, mostly Protestants. So you know, I think in the Catholic Church we seem to do a better job of dealing with those differentiations, you know, that we have a more differentiated body, if you will. So the blue-haired ladies and the monks and the friars can all exist together in the same body. But it's an intriguing question because there's, you know, within the Protestant world, there's almost a kind of built-in ambivalence about what does it mean to belong to a larger body?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to submit to authority in the church? It's a huge question. So it's just to be interesting to see what unfolds.
Yeah.
But at least I think there might be a hopeful sign in there's at least the awareness, the aspiration. I don't know that there's a blueprint.
No, but I think,
but
that's a good point because I had forgotten about that, because I think that just further speaks to the humility of the movement of understanding themselves as part of the larger whole instead of we're reinventing the wheel, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that bodes well
from
having its inceptions have that flavor of acknowledgement is better than my generation or even the, you know, 60s, 70s generation.
Yeah.
But who knows, you know, who knows what will hold, so.
We'll keep watching that fresh green shoot.
That's right. That's right. That's your job.